Okay, we've considered the various different parts of the tabernacle, starting with the talking about just the materials from which the tabernacle was made, and we see it was the finest materials. And I think some of you were quite astounded, as I was, when I discovered that the most valuable materials, not gold, but are actually the dyes. $300,000 a pound for the, and that was in 1989. I think it's even worth, been worth more today, 19 years later. It's about 20 times the value, at least 20 times the value of gold. So you can kind of figure it out. But $300,000 a pound for the Techelet and the Argamon, the purple and the blue. And I don't know how much the crimson, the tola and shani from the larva of this worm, but that also was laborious. I think they were able to collect about 2 pounds. I think 2 pounds in a day, scratching it off the leaves and off the branches and the bark to get the larvae, and then to produce the dye. But then we went and we looked. We looked at the Ark of the Covenant, the holiest place of all, and considered the mercy seat, the Kaporet, where the blood is applied. And hopefully, I'll have a chance this morning to go over with you the Day of Atonement, the five sacrifices, the significance of that, which is that was the sole responsibility and privilege of the high priest to go into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement. And we looked at the cherubim, and then we went out to the holy. Then we went out to the holy place, looked at that, and saw the table of showbread and the lamp and the golden altar. And then yesterday morning, we looked at the tent. We looked at the tent and the structure and all that's involved in that, and saw that it's really a portable temple, quite a robust structure with these heavy beams. But also the overall impression. As a matter of fact, for those who are in the cabins, I realized that when you stand at the door, okay, stand at the door of your cabin, and look up. Ours has an air conditioner at the top, little air conditioner. But when you look up, that's 15 feet. Okay? So that's the height. That would be the height of those golden beams that were on the side, and the draperies were up there. So 15 feet up. That's a ways up, considering also I'm about 6 foot, but the average, Israelite in that day was 5'6". They were shorter, and so they were shorter people. And so they'd have these golden walls. And they would look up and see those beautiful draperies of purple, you know, the blue and the purple and the crimson, with the cherubim woven into them in this incredibly intricate and skillful fashion, maaseh choshev. And so we looked at that. Then we looked at the we looked at the courtyard last night. We looked at what happens particularly at the bronze altar, the sacrifices that were brought there. And now we're going to focus in on the high priest, the officials that made it all happen. There would not be a sacrificial system. It wouldn't work unless the high priest, the priest, could bring the blood that was shed and apply it to the horns of the altar or to the horns of the golden altar in order to deal with people's sins. So we're going to focus in on the high priest. Let's look at our text together. We are now in Exodus 28. Exodus 28. And we'll read, first of all, just the introduction. And this is even loaded right here, these first five verses. Verses, as I said, 28, 1 through 5. Then bring near. Stop right there. Then bring near. Okay? That's the same wording, that's the same in the Hebrew that we find for the sacrifices. To cause to draw near. So in a sense, Moses is presenting his brother to the Lord for sacrificial service. Okay? So then bring near to yourself Aaron your brother and his sons with him from among the sons of Israel. Now that phrase even there, from among the sons of Israel, requires a little bit of explanation. It is the idea that they were, if we take a look at 1 Chronicles 23:13, we will see what that means. Just kind of a footnote. Many times you will find explanations of the tabernacle, the temple, things like that, that are not found in the the first place in which they are mentioned, whether it be in Exodus or Leviticus. You will find it in Chronicles, because Chronicles is looking at the history of Israel from the perspective of the priesthood. Okay, whereas the Book of Kings and Samuel is looking at the history of Israel from the perspective of the prophets. So here we have a perspective of the priesthood, so we have details that we don't find otherwise. And the emphasis in Chronicles is on the temple, whereas in Samuel and Kings, it's on the throne, you know, the king's throne. So just a simple way to realize the differences in Chronicles. But here we have the sons of Amram were Aaron and Moses, and Aaron was set apart to sanctify him as most holy, he and his sons forever, to burn incense before the Lord, to minister to him, and to bless in his name forever. That's what it means when it says they were from among the sons of Israel. The Lord had called Aaron to be the ones that was sanctified, set apart as most holy. By the way, the word sanctify and holy are the same in Hebrew. Okay, so to make him holy as most holy. He and his sons forever to burn incense before the Lord, and that's the prayer. The symbol we saw that in Revelation 5. That's the symbolism of prayer, to minister to him and to bless in his name forever. And the Aaronic blessing is in Numbers 6:24. So that's the meaning of that. So let's go back now. We understand that to Exodus 28 again. Okay, so that's what the meaning is, from among the sons of Israel, to minister as priests to me. And now we have a list. We have a list of the sons of Aaron. We have Aaron first, and then Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar, Aaron's sons. Now, there's no indication in Exodus 24, 1 through 11, that Eleazar and Ithamar went up on Mount Sinai. It was only Nadab and Abihu. They were supposed to be the ones that would inherit Aaron's responsibility, probably with Nadab. Since he's listed first, most likely he was the oldest. But of course, Nadab and Abihu offended the Lord, offering strange fire, and he consumed them. So now the priesthood was going to devolve on Eleazar and Ithamar, Aaron's sons. But initially, this is before the tabernacle was built. And by the way, this presumes to bring near to the Lord, presumes that the tabernacle would have had to have been built. So the consecration of Aaron happened after the tabernacle was built. And we're actually going to see the consecration of Aaron is recorded in Leviticus. Okay, Leviticus chapter 8. And we'll look at, we're not going to look at that, but you can also, you know, look at that as to reinforce what it says here in Exodus about the consecration of Aaron. Exodus tells us how it was to be done. Leviticus gives us the details of how it was done. Okay? So, we have Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar, Aaron's sons. And you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother for glory and for beauty. Now, the word glory in Hebrew has a very different connotation than our word glory. We think of an effulgence, some kind of rays emanating out. That's not the concept of glory in Hebrew. The concept for glory in Hebrew is weight, heavy, okay, heaviness. And so it's a weightiness, okay? Maybe the idea in this case, maybe a dignity, somberness, okay, a weight. Now, beauty is the standard word for beauty, teferet. That's this normal word for beauty. So these garments are beautiful, and you will see that there are the garments for Aaron will very closely resemble the tapestries of the inner tent, of the Mishkan itself, with the blue and purple and scarlet. But there's, and also the linen, there's an additional thread that's woven in Aaron's garments, and that's gold. So besides the gorgeous blue, that's that deep sky blue, and the reddish purple of the Argamon, and the crimson red, and the beautiful Egyptian sheish linen, that fine linen, twisted linen, very, very finest linen, also is going to be this gold thread woven throughout. And that's going to make his garments heavy. We're going to see that this gold is all throughout his garments, making them very, very heavy, but also incredibly beautiful. Okay, now verse 3, and you shall speak to all the skillful persons whom I have endowed with the spirit of wisdom, that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister as priest to me. Now, we're going to see tonight, particularly, the artisans, and what was involved. And we're just going to kind of make a list, one of the things, of all the various different skills that had to be in place to make all these different articles of the tabernacle. And when you start to think through it, it's mind-boggling that two men could supervise all this. I mean, here we're talking about making of clothing. Now that's a far cry from building, you know, from a building. Normally, you don't have the same person with both those skills. But in the case of Bezalel and Aholiab, the Lord enabled them to be able to supervise all of that. We're going to look at that tonight. But so you shall speak to all the skillful artisans whom I've endowed with the spirit of wisdom, that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister as priest to me. Now, there are 8 garments you're going to see when we go through here. There are 6 of them that are listed here. These are the garments which they shall make. And these are the garments which they shall make. A breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a tunic of checkered work, a turban, and a sash. Now, there are 2 additional garments that are not listed here. There is a diadem, a gold plate, that was attached to the turban. And then there are undergarments, under trousers, to cover the nakedness of Aaron and his sons. And there is a warning given to Aaron and to any priest that they must wear those under trousers, okay, in order to, and if they do not, they ever appear to be, even with their full finery, and they would, for instance, forget to wear those things, that the Lord would strike them dead. There are certain things like that. In other words, if you don't come in ringing the bells, you'll die. If you don't come in wearing the undergarments, those under trousers, you're going to die. If you don't wash your hands in the laver before you go into the holy place, you will die. Aaron is in this precarious position. It's a tremendous privilege, but it's also quite precarious. He has to be very careful. Okay? Now let's take a look at these garments Okay? And they are described for us in the subsequent section of the text. And slightly different order than we saw them here, but I think that's pretty much what I had to say. Okay, now the high priest's garments. You can see in the high priest's garments, I forgot my pointer over here. Excuse me. There we go. Okay. You can see in the high priest's garments, and I'll point out these different parts to you. This is the ephod right here. Again, this particular idea of it has the this would be this bluish color. That's Techelet, I suppose. It's supposed to have the same colors as the veil. In this reproduction, they didn't do a particularly great job of that. It's supposed to look very much like the parochet, with the addition of the gold. I think part of the problem is to reproduce a clothing like that today, with the blue, the purple, the crimson, and gold thread, it was probably prohibitively expensive to be able to do that. But this is the ephod. And then we have something called the Hebrew choshen. It's translated breastplate, but it's not really a plate. It's more of like a pouch. It's folded, and we'll have a close-up of that in just a moment. And so we have the ephod, we have a breastplate, we have a sash. Now his sash, Aaron's sash, has all those same colors in it. It has the blue, the purple, the red, the linen, and the gold. So it distinguishes him. He also wears the me'il. The me'il is this type of is this blue robe, and then he also has a checkered tunic. That's this right here. Now you can see on the bottom of the robe there are these pomegranates and bells. We're not sure if it was that way when it says that's between them. Or it might be that the bell was in the shape of a pomegranate. You can imagine how difficult that would be. I mean, we're talking about that's another skill, to be able to fashion these little golden bells. All that's involved in this is quite remarkable. Then we also have, he has a mitre on his head. And it's a little hard for you to see in this picture. Let me go to the next one. You can see this is the diadem here, okay? And on that is written, in Hebrew, it looks like they did it right, is Kodesh La'Adonai, which means holy to the Lord on the top there. So that is his mitre, the mitznefeth. Now, when we compare his garments, so let me go back here, you can see what an ordinary priest's garments will look like. Just back a few. See some of these guys around. There we go. Much simpler looking. And they had four garments. They had a sash. They had a hat. They had a much simpler robe. And they're wearing the under trousers underneath. So they had four. Scholars believe that most likely, because of the weight of what we call the overgarments, that is the robe and the ephod, the breastplate, maybe even the diadem, all that gold, that when Aaron was ministering at the bronze altar, he would wear just the simpler, called the undergarments. And when he would then go into the holy place, he would don the special overgarments of the blue robe and the special, he would still have his sash, but the ephod and the breastplate, and put on the diadem. That's what it seems to make sense. One of the reasons why is because with all of the gold woven into these garments, and then also all the gold that is in the settings of the stones, which we'll be talking about, all of that gold would make his garments extremely heavy. Gold is very heavy, very heavy. And the idea of him ministering on the altar with these beautiful garments and trying to bend over and he'd fall over. I mean, it would just be just too heavy. So when he was wearing these, the overgarments, the beautiful overgarments that look like the they looked like the draperies of the Mishkan of the tabernacle. When he was wearing those, he would just be able to do the tasks of taking care of the lamp, you know, taking the wick up. He could do that because it's mainly with his hands, offering incense, placing the bread once a week. That he could do. But all of the bending and all that was involved with, you know, with the sacrificial system and the, you know, collecting the blood and pouring it and all that, that's most think that that would probably have been just too difficult with all the weight of the gold. Now there were those also objects saying, well, he wouldn't want to get his garments bloody. I don't think that's a legitimate argument, but the weight is, I think, is a factor. I really never thought of it about that before, but with all that gold woven in, it would have been very heavy. Particularly if you look at the breastplate. The breastplate, we can kind of focus in on it here. These were heavy settings of gold. You know, this is a big gold ring with a stone in it. So this would have been very heavy, pulling him, you know, kind of pulling him forward. If he were to bend over, he would just fall over. And we don't want that to happen. So I think he would have been capable of a very stately walk when wearing this into the holy place to do what are called the inner rites of the tabernacle, the holy place, but to minister in these clothing at the bronze altar. He probably just used the same kinds of clothing that the priests were wearing, but with a nicer sash and the beautiful sash and also the special mitre. Now, let's talk a little bit about while we're here. Another thing that we're told about in terms of the ephod some of these details are very difficult. You can see that there's gold chains that are holding these epaulets right here that he has on his shoulders. These are on an onyx stone, and written upon these are the names of the tribes of Israel. And we don't know which, probably starting on his right shoulder, but we don't know for sure. But they were in the order. They were in the order of their birth. So Reuben would have been first and Benjamin last. But we don't know whether, and the rabbis debate this, okay? You know, was Reuben first on his right shoulder or was Reuben first on his left shoulder? It was probably on his right shoulder, but we don't know. There's no way of knowing. Now, what the intriguing thing and most significant thing about this is a statement that's made. Let's go back to the text as we talk about the ephod in more detail. Here, listen 5. They shall take the gold. Notice that gold is first, okay? Which means that that's probably the prominent material. There's going to be a lot of gold in these fabrics, the gold. Now, there was a. I have a book on ancient technologies that says how they did this. They didn't have this. They did not have the technology then of drawing gold through a hole, you know, making a wires of gold the way we do it today, taking advantage of the ductility of gold. What they did was they beat the gold flat as possible, into this thin, kind of thin foil, and then they cut it. And that's what was the thread, they put it together to make a gold thread. Now, that's incredibly laborious work to do that. And then how do you sew with gold thread? But anyway, so you have this ephod of gold, blue and purple and crimson and fine twisted linen, the work of the skillful workman. That's the same word that's used there, the skillful workman, ma'aseh choshev, that is used for the tabernacle, inner curtain for the parochet that separates the holy place from the holy of holies. So it was, you know, it was his garments were just gorgeous. This doesn't do it justice. I don't think anything could do it justice. the two shoulder pieces and the way it's described. Now look at verse 9. You should take two onyx stones and engrave on them the name of the sons of Israel. Six of their names on one stone, and the names of the remaining six on the other stone according to their birth. Notice it doesn't tell us right or left. It just says one stone and the second stone. As a jeweler engraves a signet, you shall engrave the two stones according to the names of the sons of Israel. And that's also a difficult thing. To take a stone, okay, to take a precious stone, onyx, and to engrave names into it without breaking it. Just think about that. If you were to put pressure on something like that where you could actually incise it and yet not break it. Again, this is, shows the incredible skill of these men who were called by God to do all this work. As a jeweler engraves a signet, you shall engrave the two stones according to the names of the sons of Israel. You shall set them in filigree settings of gold. So there's a lot of gold up, well, I don't have the picture up there, but a lot of gold up there too. This is all loaded with gold, besides all the gold here. Let's continue in the text. And you shall put the two stones on the shoulder pieces of the ephod. And this is the one, what I want you to notice. Not just all these details, okay, as beautiful as they are, but as stones of memorial for the sons of Israel. And Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his two shoulders for memorial, to bring remembrance. Aaron carries the names of the sons of Israel into the presence of God. That expression, before the Lord, is a key phrase that occurs throughout this passage. Bearing, into the presence of God. He's not just himself, he's representing the entire nation. And carrying their names, Lifnei Adonai, before the Lord, on his two shoulders. And then it goes into the details of that. Now you have chains of pure gold. Again, more and more weight, but absolutely gorgeous. You shall make them of twisted cordage work, and you shall put the corded chains on the filigree settings. Oh, I've got NAS here. I'm sorry. I should have KJV, but it's just very close. Of wreathen work, thou shalt make them, and fasten the wreathen chains to the... Ouches. Okay. Okay. And thou shalt make the breastplate of judgment. Now the breastplate, let's take a look at that. Description of a cunning work. That is that same word, ma'aseh choshev, the finest type of workmanship. After the work of the ephod, thou shalt make it. Of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet, fine twisted linen, shalt thou make it. Four square it shall be, being doubled. So that there was originally a rectangle whose length was, twice its width, and then it's folded to make a square pocket. Okay? And thou shalt set in it settings of stones, even four rows of stones. Now, before I read these names, you should realize that the third row of stones, we don't know what the stones are. Okay, they're only mentioned here and in the parallel passage in which this is made. They're not mentioned anywhere else, so we don't know what the stones were. Three of the stones are fairly commonly mentioned. What is really intriguing is that nine of these stones are mentioned as adorning the Garden of Eden. Isn't that interesting? It would have to be obviously the nine that, other than the third. The third row is the one that has the three that we're not sure about. But I will read the names of them. But Hebraeus, we don't even know exactly what these stones are. Sardius, topaz, carbuncle. These are old names, of these precious stones. This is King James, so this is from this 1611. These are the old names of the stones: Sardius, topaz, and carbuncle. Emerald, sapphire, diamond. The third row, okay, ligure, agate, and amethyst. They're just guesses. And the fourth row, beryl, onyx, and jasper. Okay? Now, just to give you an idea, let's take a look at a different translation and see what they call the stones. Let's look at the New Jerusalem Bible. And we have sard, topaz, and emerald. Second row, garnet, sapphire, and diamond. For the third row, hyacinth, ruby, and amethyst. The fourth row, that third row is the one they're only mentioned here. Beryl, cornelian, and jasper. All right? And jasper. Let's take a look at the Tanakh. Carnelian, chrysolite, and emerald. Okay, that's the first row. The second row, turquoise, sapphire, and amethyst. Third row, jacinth, agate, and a crystal. That word that's translated jacinth, that may be, this is somewhat of a conjecture, but that may be the zircon crystals, that zircon material which the Ray Project worked on. That might be zircon. It might be. Russ Humphreys is convinced that it is, but I'm not sure. Jacinth, agate, and crystal. The fourth row, beryl, lapis lazuli, which is a beautiful blue stone, and jasper. Those last three, the beryl, the lapis lazuli, and jasper, those are the ones that are mentioned very frequently together in Scripture. So beryl is like a bluish green. Lapis lazuli is a gorgeous blue color. And jasper, I think, is like a dark green or something like that. So they shall be framed with gold in their mountings. Now, these also have the names of the children of Israel on them. So let's take a look at that. And you can see that. They have the names, of course, engraved in Hebrew. This is Paleo-Hebrew. It's ancient Hebrew. Of the names, I can read a couple of them. I can see Asher. I can't see this one too clearly because of Aaron's beard. And by the way, what's wrong with Aaron's beard? Pardon me? It's not white. That's right. That's right. It's not white. And he was 80 years. What, he was 83 years old at this time. His beard was probably white. As a matter of fact, we know it was white from Psalm 133 because the unity in worship, and I guess it was eight years ago when I talked about Psalm 133, unity in worship is described as the feeling when the children of Israel were standing and watching Aaron being anointed and the beginning of the priesthood. And it describes the oil running down upon his head and upon his beard and his garments. And then as a parallel, it says, and this is like the dew coming down on Mount Hermon. Now, Mount Hermon is a tall mountain in Israel. It's over 9,000 feet. It's white-capped. Okay, so we know that Aaron had, he had white hair and a white beard from Psalm 133. So that's what's wrong with his beard. This is a very young Aaron we have pictured here. He's doing very well for 83. Okay, so here we have the four rows of stones with the names, and again, these are precious stones. These are more valuable stones than the onyx up here. They were beautifully cut, you can see, and then they were engraved. Now you take a precious, a large gemstone like that, and you try to engrave it. There's a very good chance that you're going to break it. You're going to, it's going to crack. It's going to fracture. And yet they were, the artisans were able to do this. Amazing thing. And again, look at all this gold that is here, and all gold woven into the breastplate. A huge amount of gold. The same thing is said about these stones, as is said about the epaulets on the shoulders. Okay, the stones shall correspond in number. Let's go back to KJV. The stones shall be with the names of the children of Israel, 12 according to their names, 12 stones, 12 tribes. Like the engravings of a signet, every one with his name shall they be according to the 12 tribes. Okay? Now, a little further down, now it describes the breastplate with two rings of gold. Thou shalt put the two rings on the two ends of the breastplate. And thou shalt put the two wreathed and chains of gold. And this is the way in which the breastplate is connected to the ephod and to the shoulder plates. That's what's going on in this description. And the reason why it's connected like this is so the breastplate does not fall if it's not detached from the ephod. So you can see these rings of gold. I don't know if they were this big. And the way it describes them is not ordinary rings, but some kind of a plaited work looking ring, a very, very intricate. Everything is intricate and beautiful. Nothing would be as so simple as this. It was meant to be just look like rope, like plaited, but it was gold. Just amazing. Okay? And thou shalt put the two wreathen chains of gold and the two rings which are on the end of the breastplate. And this gets a little convoluted here. And the other two ends of the two wreathen chains thou shalt fasten the two ouches and put them on. I never saw that word before in my life. I thought ouch is what happens when you stub your toe. And put them on the shoulder pieces of the ephod before it. And thou shalt make two rings of gold and shalt put them upon the two ends of the breastplate and the border thereof, which is in the side of the ephod inward. Now, what is the ephod for? What is the breastplate for? Okay, now, verse 29 again. And Aaron shall bear the names of the children of Israel in the breastplate of judgment upon his heart. When he goeth in unto the holy place for a memorial before the Lord continually. Again, he carries the names of the children of Israel when he goes in to the holy place. He carries the names of the children of Israel with him. He is their representative. It's not just for him. He's their representative. And most likely the reason why Nadab and Abihu were slain is they were thinking that the priesthood was some kind of a prerogative, a privilege, and they were not thinking about the fact that they were representing the nation. That's what the Lord tells Moses to tell his brother. We find that in Leviticus 10:3. Now, something else the breastplate is used for, and thou shalt put in the breastplate of judgment the Urim and the Tumim. Now, I have not studied in detail the Urim and Tumim, and one of the former faculty at the college just finished his dissertation just a few years ago, Dr. Bookman, on the Urim and Tumim, and exactly how they work, but they were used to determine God's will, and we don't know whether or not they were a white stone and a black stone, and you pull one out. We don't know exactly. You could read his dissertation about that. The Urim and the Tumim, and they shall be upon Aaron's heart again. When he goeth in before the Lord, again, he's carrying these things in before the Lord, and Aaron shall bear the judgment, probably in the sense here of the decision-making. This is the concept here of judgment, in words, making a judgment, not a punishment, but bear the decision-making of the children of Israel upon his heart before the Lord continually. We find that statement. That's another thing you find in this text, is that word continually. These responsibilities of Aaron are continual responsibilities. We move from the breastplate. Then thou shalt make the robe. The robe is the blue robe, and it's this blue robe, and it is the color of this is tehelet. That's the same color. That same color that is the blue of the curtains, okay, of the curtains and of the parochet, of the of the veil, of the screens, that's all that same color, this beautiful blue. And I showed you a picture of what that looks like, probably even a much prettier blue than this. And it may have been lighter if it was the color of the sky, but I don't know what the sky looked like in those days. exactly what was the color of the blue, but it would have matched. All these blues match. And but this is just the one color of this. Now it says also it has a hole in the top, and then there is a unique word that's used that it says it had a reinforcement. It's some have suggested it was some kind of a mail, you know, some kind of a metal that so it wouldn't tear. Others have suggested it was some kind of a leather collar. We do find pictures in chariot reliefs of Thutmose the IV, which would have been around this time period, that Thutmose the IV succeeded his brother who was killed at the Red Sea, Amenhotep II, and then Thutmose the IV. And we do see these Canaanite charioteers with a leather collar around their neck to protect their neck and also to keep the tunic from ripping. So that's what it might have been. But this is the blue tunic he's wearing. Let's go back to our text. Okay, so that's the robe of the ephod, all of blue. Thou shalt make a hole on top of it. In the midst thereof, it shall have a binding of woven work round about the hole. That's what it's referring to, this perhaps this leather collar. As it were, the hole of a habergeon. that is not to be rent. Okay, the Hebrew for that is tarcha, and as I said, it probably refers to the leather collar. These old English words are very interesting. That it not be rent, that's fine. But I have never habergeon. I guess it is. And beneath upon the hem of it, thou shalt make the pomegranates of blue, purple, and scarlet. J. Vernon McGee has a sermon just on the pomegranates, bells of pomegranates, and I'm not going to try to duplicate what only J. Vernon McGee can do, J. Vernon, and so I would recommend that you listen to his sermon on that. The idea of the bells is that bells had to be rung. We took look a few verses down. On the hem of the robe, it says, make pomegranates of blue, purple, and scarlet round about the hem thereof, and bells of gold between them round about. A golden bell and a pomegranate. A golden bell and a pomegranate upon the hem of the robe round about. And it shall be upon Aaron to minister, and his sound shall be heard when he goeth into the holy place before the Lord. That same expression, lifnei Yahweh there. Before the Lord, when he cometh out, that he die not. And again, Aaron is in a precarious position, great privilege, but precarious. He must do exactly and minister exactly as God says. Okay, so that is the blue robe, the me'il. And thou shalt make a plate of pure gold. Now we go to the what's called the diadem, that is this section of his clothing. Let's take a look at it in detail. Oh, you can't see, maybe you can see the next one? No, I guess we have to go back to this one. Okay, there is the plate of gold, and it was attached to the turban with a blue thread. So we have the gold and blue, very prominent, in Aaron's clothing. And I always think about the blue is certainly somehow symbolic of heaven and the color of heaven, of the sky. I think that's a very legitimate symbol, signification. Thou shalt make a plate of pure gold and engrave upon it, like the engravings of a signet, holy to the Lord. Now, there's different ways of understanding this, okay? What it literally says is holiness either belongs to the Lord, it's Kodesh L'Adonai, holiness belongs to the Lord. In other words, he's the only one who is holy. All holiness emanates from him. Or it is saying that holiness to the Lord, this is a designation of Aaron, okay, that he is holy. And maybe it's both. You know, that as priest, He is to be holy. He is set apart. But holiness to the Lord, when we're referring to the Lord's character, when we talk about holiness, it's the absolute character of his attributes is what holiness is. It doesn't really mean to be set apart. It means absolute, unique. R.C. Sproul said alien. And we shouldn't be thinking of God set apart from us. We're set apart from him. He's the standard. Okay, he is the standard of holiness. He's the standard. And so it's the concept of absoluteness. Absoluteness of love, perfect grace. You know, absolute strength, absolute beauty, absolute knowledge, absolute presence. He is holy in all his attributes. And so, certainly it's saying that holiness belongs to the Lord, but also Aaron, as the representative of the people, chosen by God to represent the people, is going to be the one who then has to be holy in ministering in the holy place. And thou shalt put on a blue lace, that it may be upon the mitre. The mitre is his hat. Upon the forefront of the mitre it shall be. It should be upon Aaron's forehead. Now, this is very interesting, and the commentators debate the meaning of this expression. We have seen each of these things carrying it before the Lord, representative. This is the strongest one of all. It shall be upon Aaron's forehead that Aaron may bear the iniquity of the holy thing, and the children of Israel shall hallow in all their holy gifts. Now, the issue here is the meaning of two Hebrew words. Nasa, which means to carry, to bear, okay, and avon. Avon can mean iniquity. It can mean the guilt, the real guilt, the forensic guilt that comes from iniquity, or it can mean the punishment that incurs upon the iniquitous one. So it seems to me, in this case, that when it says Aaron may bear the iniquity, with Nasa and Avon together, it can mean bear away. In other words, remove the iniquity, okay? Or it means can carry the responsibility of the iniquity or the guilt of the holy things. That seems to be the idea, that if an Israelite were to, when he's offering his sacrifice, if he were to do something incorrectly, the responsibility doesn't go upon him, but it goes to Aaron. Aaron will carry the responsibility for the holy things. The children of Israel shall hallow in all their holy gifts, and it shall be always upon his forehead. And let's look at this, that they may be accepted before the Lord. As Aaron carries their names into God's presence on his shoulders and on the breastplate, he also carries into the Lord's presence that statement, holiness to the Lord. That's carried into the Lord's presence. One commentator said, he was a Jewish commentator, interestingly enough, he says, this is the symbolism of God's grace. I was shocked when I heard that. It's hardly ever hear a Jewish commentator referring to grace. But that as he carries it in, that they will be accepted before the Lord. Their offerings will be accepted. Even though they're sinful people, their offerings will be accepted because the ministry of the high priest, that's how important his ministry is. And thou shalt embroider the coat is referring to. That's the same word, ketonet, is a tunic of fine linen. And thou shalt make the mitre of fine linen, and shalt make the girdle, that's his sash, of needlework. And for Aaron's sons thou shalt make coats, and thou shalt make for them girdles, and bonnets shall make for them for glory and for beauty. Even the regular priests, their garments will still be very finely made, although not as beautiful as Aaron's. And thou shalt put them upon Aaron thy brother and his sons with him, and shalt anoint them, consecrate them, and sanctify them, that may minister unto me in the priest's office. Now, let's take a look. We looked at the garments. Let's look at what's involved in the consecration. We're going to do this fast. As far as what was involved in the consecration, this is actually in chapter 29. Let's pick up there. The last verses just talk about 42 and 43, about the need to wear the linen breeches. That is the, and by the way, that word for linen is a different word than the word for the, that we've been seeing all along, the shesh, the very fine linen. This is just a common linen, and it's just for, for underdrawers, so that makes sense. But they have to cover their nakedness from the loins even unto the thighs they shall reach. They shall be upon Aaron and upon his sons when they come into the tabernacle of the congregation, or when they come near unto the altar to minister in the holy place, that they bear not iniquity and die. Okay? Therefore, again, this is something else that is very precarious. They must wear this. Aaron must ring the bells on his garments as he's walking. They must wash their hands to indicate purity, or they will die. And we see an example with Nadab and Abihu, who offer an unacceptable sacrifice, an authorized sacrifice, and God consumes them. He holds them to a much higher level than to the other people. Okay, now chapter 29. Chapter 29 gives us the details of the consecration. Now, it takes the whole chapter, so I'm just going to kind of summarize it for you. It's 37 verses. We only have 10 minutes, so what we'll do is we'll just kind of give you the details, okay? And as I read the text, 29, 1 through 3, and I'll just comment briefly. This is the thing that thou shalt do unto them to hallow them, okay? That means the same word for to make them holy, to set them apart as holy, to minister unto me in the priest's office, and it's going to involve three animals, a bull and two rams. The bull and the first ram are going to be basically the regular sin offering for a priest and his burnt offering. That's what's going to be involved in those two. So you're going to see that, and you can compare that with the appropriate places in Leviticus. Okay, and also he's going to bring unleavened bread and cakes, unleavened tempered with oil, and wafers unleavened anointed with oil of wheaten flour shalt thou make them. And thou shalt put them into one basket and bring them in the basket with a bullock and the two rams. Now what this is all about is the installation of Aaron, the consecration for him to be high priest, and also the ceremonial setting aside of that portion of the sacrifice which will belong to Aaron and his sons, and which portion of the meal offering or the grain offering which will belong to Aaron and his sons. That's what we see in this section. Okay? Now, again, Aaron and his sons, thou shalt bring unto the door, same word, bring near, unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, shalt wash them with water. That's the first thing. And now that we have these, and 1 through 3, it describes the three animals and also the various kinds of grain offering. The second step in 4 through 9, bring Aaron and his sons near to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, wash them with water, indicating purification, clothe Aaron with his special garments, anoint his head with the anointing oil. Now, again, that's Psalm 133, and if you want to see the actual, when this actually happened, that's in Leviticus 8, okay? Leviticus 8 through 10 is the actual installation of the priesthood, the beginning of the priesthood. And thou shalt take the anointing oil and pour it upon his head, and anoint him. And thou shalt bring his sons and put coats upon them. So this is also the installation of his sons. They shall gird them with girdles, Aaron and the sons, and put the bonnets on them. That's their hats. And the priest's office shall be theirs for perpetual statute, chukat olam. A statute in Hebrew is from the root chakak, which means to inscribe in stone. This is something, I mean, when you cut something into stone, I mean, it's there, okay? So a statute is that concept. So chukat olam, a perpetual statute. And thou shalt consecrate Aaron and his sons. And then we have the offering of the bullock. Well, the bullock or the bull, that is an offering for Aaron and his sons. And notice how they put their hand on the head of the bullock. This is a sin offering, just like if Aaron at a later time were to commit a sin, he would have to offer a bull as the high priest. And he puts his hand on the head of the bull to identify with that and say, this bull is being slain in my place. This is substitution. And thou shalt kill the bull before the Lord by the door. And notice who's doing the killing. This is Moses has to slay the bull in this case because he's the one who is installing Aaron. And thou shalt take the blood of the bull and put it upon the horns of the altar with thy finger and pour out the blood beside the bottom of the altar. And then remove the fat. Of course, the fat is going to be burned because the fat belongs to the Lord. That's a standard thing. But the flesh of the bullock and its skin and its dung shalt thou burn with fire without outside the camp. It is a sin offering. Now, you need to understand that the burn upon the altar, okay, it's the same word in English, and the burn with fire without the camp are two different words. The one, burn upon the altar, is caused to go up in smoke. It's the same word that's used for burning the incense. Okay, to cause it to go up in smoke. The word for burn for burn outside the camp is just saraf. It's just a normal word, just, you know, burn it up. This is the skin and the dung and all of that, all those things which are burned outside the camp. This is a sin offering, it says. So this is the sin offering for Aaron. And Aaron cannot, if we had time, also look at the Day of Atonement. But on the Day of Atonement, he has to offer, first of all, a sin offering for himself. So this is a sin offering. Then, after the sin offering, thou shalt take one ram, and Aaron and his sons shall put their hands upon the head of the ram. Now this is going to be the burnt offering, indicating his devotion to the Lord. Thou shalt slay the ram, thou shalt take its blood, sprinkle it round upon the altar. And thou shalt cut the ram in pieces, and wash the inwards of it. So this whole thing is going to be burned up. Okay, that is the burnt offering. Okay? And it's a sweet savor offering. The sin offering is not sweet savor. But burnt offering, peace offering, those are sweet savor offerings. An offering made by fire unto the Lord. Now we still have one other ram. This is called the ram of consecration in verse 19. This is the one that's very interesting, what is done with this ram. Aaron and his sons shall put their hands upon the head of the ram. They'll kill the ram and take of his blood and put it upon the, and this is what Moses is supposed to do. Take the blood and put some upon the tip of the right ear of Aaron. Literally, you know, upon his right earlobe, okay? And also upon the thumb, upon the tip of the right ear of his sons, so it's both Aaron and his sons, upon the thumb of their right hand, okay, of both Aaron and his sons, and upon the great toe, the big toe of their right foot. Now, what is the significance of the blood being applied to the right ear, okay, the thumb, and to the big toe? That symbolism is pretty well understood, okay? His hearing, what he hears, is consecrated to the Lord. He's only going to do what the Lord tells him to do. That's why the blood is applied to the ear. Why to the thumb? Well, because what he's going to do with his hands is consecrated unto the Lord. And where he goes with his feet is consecrated unto the Lord. He's only going to hear he's supposed to only hear what God says and obey it. Not just hear, but obey. He's only supposed to do what God tells him to do. And he's only supposed to go where God tells him to go. So all those three things, hearing, obedience, actions with his hands. He's going to be working in the holy place, tending the lamps and offering incense and the bread. And also the different places he's going in the tabernacle and ministering the sacrifices, all of that is consecrated unto the Lord. And the same thing is done to his sons, not just to Aaron. Then it shall take the fat of the ram and the rump and the fat that covereth the inward, and now the fat is burned up to the Lord. Okay, it's a realm of consecration. And what is done is that the portion of the ram and the portion of the breads that are described, they are lifted up to indicate this is what Israel is going to give Aaron and his sons as their food. This is they're going to be their due to the priests. That's what's going on in these verses. And thou shalt receive them of their hands and burn them upon the altar for a burnt offering, again for a sweet savor, verse 25, before the Lord. And then verse 26, and thou shalt take the breast of the ram of Aaron's consecration and wave for a wave offering. The breast of the animal will be Aaron's portion and the portion of his sons. Thou shalt sanctify the breast of the wave offering and the shoulder of the heave offering which is waved and which is heaved up of the ram of the consecration, even of that which is for Aaron and that which is for his sons. And it shall be for Aaron and his sons by a statute, that's that same word, forever, hukat olam, for the children of Israel, for it is a heave offering, and it shall be a heave offering for the children of Israel of the sacrifice of their peace offerings. And even the portion of the peace offering, which the worshiper can eat, a portion of that will go to Aaron and his sons, whoever the officiating priests. And the holy garments of Aaron shall be his sons after him, to be anointed therein and to be consecrated in them. And that son that is priest in his stead shall put them on 7 days when he cometh to the tabernacle of the congregation to minister in the holy place. The last thing in this section is the consecration of the altar. And verse 35. The ceremony I just described to you, okay, but it's described. That is done 7 days in a row. Okay, look at here at verse 35. And thus shalt thou do unto Aaron and to his sons, according to all things which I have commanded thee, 7 days shalt thou consecrate them. So for 7 days, this same ceremony. Thou shalt offer every day a bull for a sin offering for atonement. Thou shalt cleanse the altar. This is also a preparation for the altar. When thou hast made an atonement for it, and thou shalt anoint it to sanctify it. So now the altar is being prepared to be the place for Israel to bring their sacrifices. 7 days thou shalt make atonement for the altar. It's this kind of text which suggests that atonement has the idea of purification and not just simply covering. This is an atonement for the altar. It's the same word that's used, kepher, that is used in the Day of Atonement. And sanctify it, and it shall be an altar most holy. Whatsoever touches the altar shall be holy. Now this is that which they shall offer upon the altar. 2 lambs of the first year, day by day continually. The one lamb thou shalt offer in the morning. The other lamb shalt thou offer at even. And with the one lamb, a tenth deal of flour mingled with the fourth part. This is always offered morning and evening. It's always upon the altar. And the fourth part of a hin of wine for a drink offering. And the other lamb thou shalt offer at evening and shalt do thereto according to the meat offering in the morning. And according to the drink offering thereof, for a sweet savor, an offering made by fire unto the Lord. This shall be a continual burnt offering. Okay? Ola tamid, a continual burnt offering throughout your generations at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before the Lord, where I will meet with you. That's what the Lord is saying. I will meet you to speak there unto thee, and there I will meet with the children of Israel. Read this last night. And the tabernacle shall be sanctified by my weighty presence. That's what glory is, by my weighty presence. And I will make holy the tabernacle, the congregation, and the altar. I will make holy also both Aaron and his sons to minister to me in the priest's office. And I will dwell among the children of Israel and will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord their God that brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, that I may dwell among them. Interesting connection here. Remember when we started, we went back to Exodus 5:22 through 6:8. The Lord saying that, I will make you my people, I will be your God. I remember I brought you out of Egypt. It's all tied together again right here in this verse. They shall know that I'm the Lord their God that brought them forth out of the land of Egypt. Why? That I may dwell among them. That's why he brought them out. I am the Lord their God. Let me close by looking at a passage at some passages in Hebrews. That didn't work. Wait a minute, why did that happen? Right, so let me see here. High priest, I'm going to try that again. There we go. What I want to do is to tie this in to Christ's high priestly ministry. This computer's not cooperating here. There we go. There are 16 references in the book of Hebrews where the word a high priest is used. And just think about all the things that we've talked about, how the high priest represented the nation before God. And, of course, the high priest is the one on the Day of Atonement who will take the blood of the sin offering, the goat, and a lot is cast. There's two goats, and one is picked as the sin offering. The other one is going to be the goat for Azazel, which is a difficult concept, but very often translated scapegoat. I think it means for the wilderness. It's the goat that's taken out into the wilderness. And the sins of the people are transferred onto that goat. And then it's taken out by a reliable man who makes sure that the goat doesn't come back. Look what it says here, starting with in Hebrews 2:17. Wherefore, in all things it behooved him to be made like unto his brethren, he might be a merciful and faithful high priest. Christ is our high priest. I was talking with Gary yesterday. We were just commenting that Christ is high priest. He is the sacrifice. He is the tabernacle. In short, he is everything. He is everything. Faithful high priest. And in Hebrews 3:1, wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our profession, Christ Jesus. And then 4:14, seeing then that we have a great high priest that has passed into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. For we have not an high priest who can be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. So he didn't have to offer a sin offering like Aaron did. He didn't have to have a sin offering for every day for 7 days before he could become high priest, because he was sinless. And every offering that was offered pointed to that, because they were to be perfect without blemish. There would be a tamim offering without blemish. Hebrews 5:1. For every high priest taken from among men is adorned for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. That's a great definition as the writer of Hebrews is looking back and summarizing the ministry of the high priest. And Hebrews 5:5. So also Christ glorified not himself to be made an high priest, but he said unto him, Thou art my son, today have I begotten thee. God the Father designated him to be our high priest. Now, Christ is of a different tribe. He is not of the tribe of Levi, okay? He is of the tribe of Judah. He's of David's tribe. He's a descendant of David, who was from Judah. And we see that in Ruth 4:18, the connection between David back to Perez, who's the son of Judah. So here we have in verse 10, he was called of God and high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now that's Psalm 110, verse 4. By the way, Psalm 110 is the most quoted section in the New Testament. Called of God and high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And then it's talking about Christ's high priestly minister, whether the forerunner is for us entered, even Jesus made a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Hebrews 7:26. For such an high priest became us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and made higher than the heavens. Christ's high priesthood is of a different caliber. It's a different tribe. It's a holy high priest who can offer doesn't have to offer a sin offering for himself. He offers himself as the sin offering for sinners, like you and like me. In Hebrews 8:1. Now the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such an high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heavens. And verse 3, every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices, wherefore is of necessity that this man have someone also to offer. Now, what did he offer? He offered himself. He offered himself as the sacrifice for sins. He is everything. He offered himself. He is high priest. He is the sacrifice. He is the tabernacle. He is everything. And Hebrews 9:7. But into the second went the high priest alone once a year. Is talking about into the Holy of Holies, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the errors of the people. Okay? But look at verse 11. But Christ became a high priest of good things to come by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. That is to say, not of this building. Neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by his own blood he entered once into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption for us. Not that he should offer himself often, as the high priest entered into the holy place every year with blood of others. This was a yearly thing, the blood, the Day of Atonement. But verse 27, as it is appointed unto men once to die, but after this the judgment, so Christ was once offered to bear the sins of many. And you think about that Christ, what it says here, that verse, when I read that verse after doing this study and looked back at what it said, that Aaron bore the sins, bore the guilt of the sons of Israel, that's it. Christ was once offered to bear the sins of many and to take all the responsibility, all the guilt, all the punishment. Because the word avon can mean the punishment that is due to iniquity. Bore the sins of many, and unto them that look for him shall he appear the second time without sin unto salvation. A high priest over the house of God. And we're reminded in as we look at what Hebrews has to say about Christ's high priestly ministry. I just want to look at this one little section here in Hebrews, starting with verse 13:12. Wherefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered without the gate. It's talking about the fact that the animals, the remains of the animals that was not offering for sin, was taken outside the gate and burned out there, and explains why Jesus, when he was crucified outside the border of Jerusalem, where they crucified the prisoners, the miscreants. They were crucified outside. And the reason why it was in this case was to, again, that Christ would fulfill in every single way the aspects of the sacrifice, that the sacrifice was offered and then it was also burned outside the camp. So Christ is everything. He's everything. He's the tabernacle. He's the sacrifice. He's the high priest. Now tonight we're going to look at how this was all put together. Just amazing. We have looked at, up to this point, we have been looking at the instructions of how it was to be built. Now we're going to look tonight at actually how it was built, the order it was done, the artisans that were called, all that's involved with that. That's what we'll be doing tonight. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for this consideration of the high priest, the garments. We just see the beauty. We see the dignity, the responsibility, the privilege, the precariousness of it all, and yet all of it we see a picture, a foreshadowing, an adumbration of Christ's greater high priestly ministry, who didn't need to offer a sacrifice for sin. Being sinless, he was the sacrifice. He offered himself, and therefore he is high priest. He is the sacrifice. He is the tabernacle who dwelt among us and one day will dwell with us and we with him forever. We thank you for that great reality to which we look forward to. And we pray, Lord, that you will continue to teach us from your word. May your Holy Spirit continue to be our guide and illuminate your word to us as we consider these things. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.